12-12-12, certainly a date that the world will not experience again for a century. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today on RBN for people who can handle the truth. RBN's website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit spingola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to spingola1@yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna@spingola.com, but I do not access that email account during the program. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button at my website, spingola.com, or by going to spingolachatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Michael Kirsch. He is with LaRouchePack.com, and he's written a marvelous article. It's actually quite lengthy. What is it, about 48 pages or so, about Andrew Jackson. And at the beginning of this article, he says, the Jackson administration was the greatest crime in the history of the United States, not merely because it was the first time a wholly foreign-owned president sat in the White House, destroying the policies of the United States adopted by the people since 1789, but because it left an array of prejudices and axioms which have continually wrought the destruction of our nation. In this document, the policy shift which the Jackson administration brought about is demonstrated, and the lies which have since been told, demolished by the voices of those who have been silenced for nearly two centuries, including John Quincy Adams, other key statesmen at the time, and the people themselves. And this is certainly something that I have been saying, and I believe that history is prologue, and that in order to understand what is going on today, we need to understand what happened in history. So welcome to the program, Michael.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you for inviting me on.
Well, it's your article is wonderful. It's actually more of a mini book. It's a booklet, and people can access that through the link that I have on my website on the schedule page. My atomic clock, the batteries in my atomic clock died just before going on the program, so I am just lost without my atomic clock.
So, well, I've got one here in front of me.
Okay, so at 4:29, we're going to go to a break.
Okay, well, 12:03:35 here.
Okay, so you're gonna be the timekeeper today. So, all righty. So, why did you write this article, this booklet, and how has it been received?
Okay, well, I can tell you, I wrote this as an intervention into this blockhead Congress that we have right now, which all they want to talk about is what they're going to cut, how much debt there is, and how to go about it, whether we want to cut off our left hand or our right foot. And the legacy of Andrew Jackson and Van Buren, which really was not Andrew Jackson himself. He was controlled, as I go through in that article, by various people like Aaron Burr and Jeremy Bentham and John Randolph. That legacy created the very same axioms that are making this Congress incapable of turning the tide and doing what Franklin Roosevelt did in 1932, throwing the speculators out on the street and reorganizing this whole financial system.
All right, we are going to a break, and we'll be right back with our guest today, Michael Kirsch, after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Michael Kirsch. The website is LaRouchePack.com/Andrew Jackson. If you would like to look at this 48-page article, and I'm not any more crazy about Franklin Roosevelt than I am about Andrew Jackson. And so we probably don't agree on the solution, but we certainly agree. On the myth of Andrew Jackson and some of the people that did control him, and he certainly was under their control and was quite the scoundrel, in my opinion. So anyway, pick it up.
Okay, well, as I was saying, the reason I wrote this was to intervene right now and maybe a last chance here before we go into what is a Bernanke Federal Reserve ECB plan for hyperinflation. And what we have to do is take all of these, you know, these derivatives and these funny money instruments and wipe them clean by reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act. But following that, we have to get enough credit to rebuild the U.S. economy, rebuild the industries, and launch an array nationwide of internal improvement projects. And one of the projects that I've been working on and working with pushing for people in Congress to go for and other farmers and things around the country is a nationwide flood and drought control plan called NWAPA. And the way in which we have to finance this is going to be very similar to the Bank of the United States and how that built the canals and the rails and financed and coordinated the nation's resources. And it was the people's bank. It wasn't a government bank. And it was not, as people want to say today, like the Federal Reserve.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct.
So this is the story, and a lot of people out there, you know, they don't like the Federal Reserve. They're angry, but they think we have to go back to something gold and silver, or we have to do something like this. And this paper demonstrates that the axioms of the idea that money itself has some kind of inherent value are based in what was actually an operation carried out from the standpoint, from the eyes of Great Britain and the British Empire, who were seeing a country breaking the chains of colonialism, moving forward with with protective tariffs, a national bank that was providing the credit for moving out west for industry, and launching this whole system. They said, we have to stop this. And the way that they had to stop it after they lost the War of 1812 was Plan B, and that was Andrew Jackson.
Right.
And what they did is that Aaron Burr wrote a letter to his son-in-law, Joseph Alston. I go through on this, and he said, we have to stop Monroe and Madison, Jefferson, Washington, George Washington. We have to stop this system, and we have to bring in somebody, and that man is Andrew Jackson. And what they did was to create this man who maybe personally he didn't like the British. You know, his mother and other relatives died in the war. But all of the people he worked with were the highest level. John Randolph was a cousin, his stepfather at a very young age. He became part of the Tucker family. John Randolph's cousin, brother-in-law, was head of the British East India Company in 1840s, but he was a director in 1826. So you're looking at, and his other relatives were British admirals. And he was directly controlling the mind of Jackson and writing to him and pushing for the southern slave owners to, you know, break free of this system of tariffs and internal improvements and really break up the nation. And that's what you can see in my paper, that John Quincy Adams forecasts that the Jackson administration actually leads us to the Civil War by promoting all of the interests of the southern slave owners and the related British interests that they were tied to.
And I believe that he was also responsible for the 1837 crash in which so many farmers lost their land, and it was just a disaster.
Oh, yeah, it was. Go ahead.
Yeah, some of the policies that he imposed were just awful. And he was, after all, he was a slave owner himself and was part of the elite. And the myth behind him, including what he was supposed to have done, destroying the bank. Yes, he did destroy the bank, but the bank was okayed by Congress. It was regulated by Congress, the Second Bank of the United States. And he did not really pay off the debt. It was the person in charge of the bank that got the debt paid off, and it was his plan to do that. And Jackson, I believe, took credit for the whole thing.
That's right. It sounds like you've done a lot of study on this. That's exactly right. It was really the deft management, if you looked at Biddle, in dealing with constant
right.
speculation overseas, attacks on the currency and the control, and right, managing through really detailed, complex arrangements to be able to pay off the debt at the same time provide the credit for the nation. And the debt was also, though, fixated by Jackson as something to pay off to then provide the reason to completely drop the high protective tariffs that we needed to break from the British, to drop the use of the sales of the public lands for canals and roads and rails. And those were the two sources which were, you know, revenues to the government, which were then all channeled to paying off the debt. And once the debt was paid off, they said, well, looks like we don't need to promote manufacturing anymore, and we don't need to develop canals. And so what they did is they used the debt as paying off the debt as an excuse to dissolve the ties that held the Union together.
Right. And didn't he also move the financial system from Philadelphia to New York, because that is where his banking friends were?
Yeah, some of the specifics of that I'm not sure exactly about, but yes, New York banks took over with Jackson. Aaron Burr came back from staying at Jeremy Bentham's house, who was a key intelligence asset of Lord Shelburne, you know, the head of the whole British Empire. And Jeremy Bentham and Burr, they stayed together as best friends for 2 years. And he came back and slipped into New York City with Van Buren, brought back this New York speculative banking machine. And these are banks that wanted to charge 8%, and the National Bank loaned at 6%. And these were banks that were, you know, just using money for their own sake rather than what really the branches of the Bank of the United States were around the country, which were all just representatives of the farmers. They were representatives of the people's property. They didn't have any funds that weren't already loaned out for those purposes. So they were correctly understood. It's just different names for the farms and the canals, and that's what the banks were. They weren't this kind of speculative Wall Street things we have today. That Wall Street legacy came from Van Buren's New York political machine and Aaron Burr. And right, after this Jackson operation, Wall Street and the slave owners took over. And so this, we can discuss this myth, but it is really a bad myth in Congress, and it's the weak flank of both the Republican and Democratic parties. They think that they are being patriots by following this knucklehead tradition about debt and fixation and let's just cut everything rather than use the powers of Congress to develop the country.
All right. Now, as I understand it, too, Andrew Jackson really didn't have any loyalties to the United States government. He figured that it was a short-lived entity, and he was really kind of favoring the Spanish because that's where he got his land. He was a slave owner, and a lot of the slave owners in the South were actually his buddies from up north who came down and took over the Indian lands and shoved the Indians westward.
Yeah, 2 points on that before we go into the break. On the first one, Aaron Burr, the reason he shot Hamilton was because Hamilton had, for various reasons, one of Hamilton was a whole patriot, there's a whole other show on this, but Hamilton had exposed Burr's plot to have New England and New York State secede from the Union. And ruined his governor campaign around that by exposing that. Aaron Burr then went down after prostrating himself to the King of England, and you can see that in the opening of my paper, offering his services in any way he could be of service. But he said, I want to secede the western part of the U.S., and he worked with Edward Livingston, another Jeremy Bentham ally, down in the south, and to seize Louisiana and break the western part of the country away. And then, as you otherwise said, yes, we'll get into the whole South, all of these, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee. Slavery was not rampant there until Andrew Jackson kicked out all of the Indians and moved them west.
Right. Now, Aaron Burr left the Senate on March 3rd, 1797, And then Jackson came in and basically took his seat. But John Jacob Astor was actually financed Aaron Burr. Isn't that correct?
I think, yeah, he was definitely in that. He was in that financing. And that was the anti-George Washington Astor fur company that was also very, very degrading to the Indians.
Oh, absolutely. That was amazing stuff. So I don't know what time it is, but...
If you want to get onto your break at 19:29, you go ahead now.
Okay.
It's 12:19. I got the sheet in front of me here if you need this. 12:19 now.
Great. Okay, we are going to a quick 3-minute break where we'll hear some words from our sponsors, and then we'll be right back with our guest today, our timekeeping guest. All right, welcome back. Our guest today is Michael Kirsch. That's K-I-R-S-C-H. And the website where you can read this document is LaRouchePack.com/AndrewJackson. I'm not a fan of Mr. LaRouche. He has said some wonderful things. Some of the books and things that have been produced by the organization are absolutely fabulous, such as Drug Inc. But we do have some differences of opinion, but we do not have any differences of opinion. I don't have any difference of opinion regarding Andrew Jackson. Okay.
Well, I don't know I just want to make the point that, as I said before for our listeners, this is not an abstract educational study just to hopefully future generations will finally understand the truth. This is the gripping axiomatic system that is making it impossible right now for the U.S. Congress to break from this stranglehold. If you remember, there was a bailout of the Wall Street speculative banks in 2008, and there was outrage of the population against this fixation then in 2009 by the Obama administration to say we have to deal with health care and cut $10 trillion over the next decade. And that switched the discussion from what we should have done. And as I say, I mentioned Franklin Roosevelt. In 1932, he took the banks through bankruptcy reorganization. That's what you do with a speculative bubble. And instead of that, the Obama administration said, no, the real problem here is grandma, and we've got to cut all this money from health care. Now, people were outraged at the fact that topic had just been switched, and suddenly 2010 there was a wipeout of Democrats, a vote against the Obama administration's failure to deal with the bailout. But then what came in was this Tea Party group of Republicans that suddenly they joined in, said, yeah, you're right, forget Wall Street and reinstating Glass-Steagall and wiping out the speculators, let's just keep cutting. And that discussion has not stopped. Then you have the super committee set up by Obama, unconstitutionally appointing 12 people to decide what gets cut, and following the dictation of David Beers of a British foreign rating agency, saying you guys have to cut your debt. What we really have to do is reorganize the system and bring back a credit source. You can never get out of an economic collapse, as we have now, because we shut down our manufacturing for 30 years without a credit source. And that's why I referenced Franklin Roosevelt. His Reconstruction Finance Corporation was an attempt at bringing back a Bank of the United States, a credit available for lending. The problem is a lot of people out there, they don't like the Federal Reserve, but they're cooped with this idea of Ron Paul that the Federal Reserve is like the Bank of the United States, or the only alternative is gold and silver. The alternative is to restore the powers of Congress over our finances and not be dictated to by foreign empires, monetary empires, of what we can or cannot do. If we can control our financial system and reorganize a third bank of the United States, we could and get rid of this funny money, of all the speculation out there by reinstating Glass-Steagall, we could rebuild our manufacturing and rebuild our United States and create jobs and again, make money in the currency a reflection of productivity rather than a reflection of speculation. And
oh,
that's
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, we definitely. The productivity is really the backbone of the whole economic system. And if you've outsourced all your productivity and sent all the production of all these products and all these manufacturing companies out of the country, then your money is based on nothing except, as you say, speculation.
And let's take up what you've written about and what you're interested in with the 37 crash. That crash was created by Jackson's illegal, completely legal, and I list the six impeachable offenses of Roger Taney and Jackson with the removal of the deposits in 33. But that process of saying we're going to shut down the credit currency, the national currency, and we're going to go to these state banks, and then we're going to have all this idle funds of it without being invested in long-term investment, and we'll make it available for speculation. And they create all the idle funds of the state banks then created a mass speculation of land, goaded on by the executive, created a bubble, and then supposedly to deal with this bubble, Jackson in 1836 said, we're not going to accept any currency anymore. The way that we've grew the economy before on credit, now we're going to only accept gold. And gold was a gold reserve. It was a small portion, and the rest of the economy was based on credit. It wasn't based on the legal money, gold and silver. It was based on a payment system much preferred by the people. And what they did is they imposed something called the specie circular, said we only accept gold now, gold and silver. And all of a sudden, massive collapse of the whole system because they also had violated the Distribution Act. And this created a double collapse of the banking system. And we can get to this after the break. But the response to that 8037 crash is exactly the problem we're facing now.
Right. All right. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Michael Kirsch, and he has written this fabulous 48-page paper. Now, several notable people, Aaron Burr, Albert Gallatin, Martin Van Buren, August Belmont, who was a Rothschild agent, John Slidell, and Caleb Cushing, appeared to be serving as agents for the British in their respective communities of Boston, New York, and in the South following the American Revolution. They packaged Jackson, a Freemason who was also pro-British, as a war hero. Am I correct? Michael, are you there? What happened to Michael? Did we lose Michael? I seem to have lost. What's going on here? Is Michael? Okay, we lost Michael, so we're going to get him back. I wonder if it was something I said. Okay, one of the things that people really don't understand about Andrew Jackson is the fact that when he closed the bank, the Second Bank of the United States, that he took all of the money that was in the bank, the people's money, the money that was paying pensions, the savings of the people who put their trust in the Second Bank. When he took the bank, the money out of that Second Bank, illegally, he took that money and he put it in the banks in New York, the banks of his friends, who then speculated and lost much of it. Now, there was a group from Philadelphia who went to talk to Andrew Jackson as president and to tell him exactly how they felt about what he did. And he basically didn't even allow them to talk. He just told them that that was what he did. And his actions did cause the 1837 crash, where people lost their farms And the myth that we've all been taught to believe actually came from a book that was written by Stan V. Henkels, H-E-N-K-E-L-S. And he wrote this book quite a while after the fact. Let me look and see if I can find the date when he wrote this book. But it created the myth. Let's see, he wrote it in 1928. And it has been republished and reprinted and repackaged, and it has made him, Jackson, this hero. And really, he doesn't deserve that status. Okay, do we have Michael back yet? Nope. Okay. Well, we have people in the chat room who are kind of wondering what the heck is going on, and because this is not what they have heard. They have heard that Andrew Jackson was this wonderful guy, that he got rid of the bank, and that is just all propaganda. And I hate to break it to people who really believe it, but it is the truth. Do we have, okay, Michael? We lost you.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there with the connection. Sorry about that. So I don't know if you wanted me to continue where we left off, or if you had some other route. We were talking about the 37 crash.
Right. I was just telling the listeners what led up to it, the fact that he closed the bank, took all this money out, belonged to the pensioners, belonged to the farmers, belonged to the people. And I just briefly mentioned the group of people who went to Washington to talk to Jackson about this. And basically, he really didn't even listen to them. And it's part of the official record.
And people can see in the report that I put out, I think documents that have almost never been republished. There, I found them 1834 Senate documents, which were all of the letters from the farmers and the people around the country. And in there, they make the point. They say the bank notes are called the poor man's capital. It was the poor. They say. That what the actions the administration are doing are creating an aristocracy of wealth,
yes.
Which and against the abject poor. And instead of this populist slogans you get today by people around the country saying that, you know, this was the great money power, the bank was corrupt, it was an aristocracy of wealth, those were the rotten slanders by people like, you know, Benton and Jackson. Who created then the mob of partisans who just believed everything they said.
And speaking of mobs, there were so many riots after this. People were killing each other. There were more riots during the Jackson administration than just about at any other time.
Wow, yeah.
It was like today. It was like the mob we saw yesterday. In Michigan? People beating each other up.
It was a weapon that was unprecedented. It was the weapon of calumny, so that it didn't matter the 20,000 people who lived in D.C. and what they said in the halls of Congress in going through the legal motions. What they said didn't matter because they controlled the press of these 150, 200 newspapers. That just fired on command everything that the Globe, which was Francis Blair was Amos Kendall's longtime collaborator, whipping up mobs out in Kentucky with this relief party, which also tried to force through unconstitutional measures. And Blair's press circulated the slanders around the country so that even though the congressional investigations, every single one of them, and that's what I demonstrate in the pamphlet, turned out that the Congress found there was absolutely no violations of the bank that warranted any legal proceedings. And the administration, in fact, never attempted to create a legal proceeding against the bank. They never called the Attorney General to investigate the bank. They didn't want to find anything wrong because there was no violation of the charter that they could use. What they wanted to do was create the trial in the press. And now that is the precedent of such action. And yes, whipping up these mobs into running down the streets with martial music. I go through that in the pamphlet, what the Irishmen are saying, attacking this bullying and of politics and the elections around the country. It was completely unprecedented, and this is the main thing for the listeners who think, well, there must have been something the bank did, right? But in fact, there was never a trial against the bank that led to its destruction.
Right. And the first Secretary of the Treasury that he brought into office would not accommodate his desire to take all these funds out. So he just got rid of him and got somebody who would.
And that's really the shocking thing, right? They got rid of him, but then they put in a second guy. McLean said he wouldn't do it, so they put in William DeWayne. And William DeWayne said, I'm not going to do this. It's not going to hurt the bank anyway. It's only going to hurt the people. And besides, it's just not legal for me to do this. And William DeWayne, he said, when he was being forced, I can read this from the report. He says, it is true there is an irresponsible cabal that has more power than the people are aware of. There is an undercurrent, a sly, whispering, slandering system pursuit. And he says that even though four of the six members of the cabinet are against it, their exertions were nullified by individuals whose intercourse with the president was clandestine. Factious and selfish views alone guided those who had influence with the executive, and the true welfare and honor of the country constituted no part of their objects. And this was the group. These were the Venetian orchestration type operations that were going on by Amos Kendall and Van Buren. Kendall, who's completely out of line for any responsibility. He's fourth auditor of the Treasury, meaning he can't be held accountable for anything. So it's like the kings of Europe. Their advisors are telling him what to do, and you can't attack anyone because it's not clear who's running things. And that was this return with this system. And so they threw out DeWayne and brought in a third Treasury Secretary, Taney, who then carried out the will of Jackson.
Right. And then for a reward for doing that, he was put in on the Supreme Court. And I believe that was his reward.
And he ruled the famous Dred Scott decision, which said that black people can never be citizens of the United States, and the Congress has no right to intervene. That's
right.
Roger Taney. That is the man who carried out this destruction of the bank.
Right. And during the Jackson administration, by the end of the second term, he had negotiated almost 70 treaties with the Indians. And during his administration, the U.S. seized about 100 million acres of Indian land. And so, I mean, you have to really look at this guy through a different kind of lens than what we've all been taught.
And it's also, sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, it's also this idea that the horrible legacy of the United States, it's not the horrible legacy of the United States, because these guys were not patriots of the United States. This was, as you say, just unlawful, unconstitutional group of thugs. And the legacy, this horrible legacy of the United States, of the genocide against the Cherokees and the removal of the Native Americans from all their land, that is not a United States legacy. This is Andrew Jackson's legacy.
Right. I think it started under Jefferson, but Jackson is the one that carried it out, totally carried it out.
Yeah, you had people, John Quincy Adams is on the floor of the Senate saying we have to end slavery. Alexander Hamilton pioneered the anti-slavery society with John Jay and other people, the people who were building the canals, the people who were the stockholders of the Second Bank of the United States with Nicholas Biddle, who were pushing the internal improvements. They were all anti-slavery. They were pushing for the elevation of man and equality of man by making it possible for all of the poor classes to rise, buy a piece of land on credit, and move over the course of a generation to a higher standard of a status and a standard of living, to be a young manufacturer and rise from an apprentice and get your own factory. And this was possible through credit. This idea of the American tradition being you just got to work it. It's got to be pure free enterprise. It's just me with my gold, and I'm going to make it from square one. That's not the American dream. The American dream was a government that had an integral relation and a completely constitutional relation to the development of the resources of the country.
Right.
Through this kind of system.
And you mentioned Martin Van, we both mentioned Martin Van Buren, who was really tied to the Tammany Society in New York. And when you look at the background of all these people, Francis Preston Blair and Amos Kendall, who they all referred to as the kitchen cabinet, William B. Lewis, John Overton, Roger B. Taney, these were all people who were very elite, well-to-do, and many of them had ties to the New York banks.
And England. I mean, these were the Tories, and this is the other thing people in the U.S. don't understand today. Yeah, they had ties to the New York banks. New York Finance and Wall Street was a British operation, was controlled after the 37 crash by British Credit, London Credit, forcing the gold standard. And these guys were, I mean, look at Burr was directly offering his services to the Queen, or the King of England at the time. John Randolph's relatives were all British East India officials. The British East India Company was forcing this doctrine of free trade, laissez-faire, as a way in which to keep the colonies in control without having to have military force soldiers around the world. And the empire said, we're going to control the U.S. with free trade, laissez-faire, and get them to swallow this dogma and become remain colonial raw material producers. All of these guys, so many of them, they were Tories. Roger Taney was against the War of 1812. Ron Randolph was on the floor of the Congress attacking the War of 1812. These were the controllers in the minds of Jackson. And the idea that Jackson was carrying it out, he was every step of the way, which is incredible. The only way that the administration worked is that he actually believed, or at least he didn't mind lying each step of the way. He was told to say one thing, and he said it. Then he was told to say a contradictory thing, and then he said it, such as, you know, the status of the bank. Clay and Calhoun are you know, running, they control the bank. All these various steps along the way, he just went along with whatever he was told as a madman who, you know, liked to shoot Indians and get in brawls.
Yeah, he was a brawler. He had quite the reputation for being a brawler. And the record states that when he was talking to Biddle, Jackson told Biddle that he was very thankful to him for his plan of paying off the debt. It was never Jackson's plan, but people attributed that plan to him decades after he was dead.
And this is the I'd like to just turn the listeners to this, the opening of this paper, which I composed, which is Jackson's December 1832 speech. And this is when the mask of the administration falls off. This is, he's gotten reelected, and now he's exposing, and he says that the administration's policy will be for the best part of the population, the wealthy landowners, the slave owners, and he drops manufacturing. He pulls all stocks out of internal improvements. He drops the use of the public lands, he says, will no longer serve as a source of revenue for the government. And John Quincy Adams, what I start this off with, is all the quote from John Quincy Adams and his demonstration that this is an all reversal of everything that we've been building since George Washington. And the role of John Quincy Adams is something we can discuss more, which is the thing that is left out of all the populist slogans today in favor of Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, it's just amazing when you look at the history, because we've been told so many things, and they're all myths. And if you really look at what was done, you have to rethink it and not accept other people's opinions that are based on myths. And it was really robbing the poor to aid the rich. In fact, there's an article by David Grimstad, which is entitled Robbing the Poor to Aid the Rich, and how Roger B. Taney and the Bank of Maryland swindled all this money out of the poor, out of the landowners, the farmers, the common man.
Yeah, they did. They squandered all of the public funds, all the hard-earned. It was the people's bank. It was their property, and they destroyed
it. Right.
It was not a government bank. Jackson wanted a government bank. He wanted a Federal Reserve. He wanted all the money to run through them. And then by making it gold, they and Abraham Lincoln attacks this in his sub-treasury speech.
Right. All righty. I hear the music, which means we are going to a break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Michael Kirsch, and the document that we are looking at today is from LaRouchePack.com/AndrewJackson. And there was something else that they did, that these this kitchen cabinet, the Roger B. Taney Group, and he was head of, he was very tied to the elite, and didn't he, because of his position in the government, that they got some money, basically used government money to compensate for some of their losses, and that it was something like $500,000 of government money that Taney supplied through his political maneuvering, and basically shifted it into private hands.
This is the hallmark of the sub-treasury system that Van Buren later set up. Roger Taney was a stockholder in the Union Bank of Baltimore.
Right.
And this was one of the six violations. And John Quincy Adams has this great statement in his speech on the removal of the deposits where he says he'd like to introduce a resolution, resolved that the thanks of this House be given to Roger B. Taney for his pure and disinterested patriotism in transferring the use of the public funds from the Bank of the United States, where they were profitable to the people, to the Union Bank of Baltimore, where they were profitable to himself. But this is rampant throughout the whole administration. The post office was the greatest corruption. It ended up insolvent in 18. It used to be profitable, and what they did is they got all their friends and they would pay them enormous, 10 times the cost of delivering the mail and other things that the post office did, pay them the contracts. It ended up under congressional scrutiny, and instead of course, sacking the guy, Jackson just appointed him to a high-salaried position overseas. The post office, as I said, became completely bankrupt. They knocked out about 2,000 good men, put in party officials, and they used it to control newspapers and other things. Samuel Swartout, who was Aaron Burr's aide, who traveled to England with him and set up him to live with Jeremy Bentham, who later then in 1812, when Samuel Swartout came back, he became Jackson's aide down in New Orleans. Samuel Swartout ripped off $1.2 million from the federal government as head of New York Customs. New York Customs collecting the duty money, he just stole it from the people. Now, $1.2 million at the time of 1838, when he ran and fled the country with this money, John Quincy Adams' administration annually was $13 million. So just to give you a sense of that, almost one-tenth of the whole federal revenue this guy, Samuel Swartout, put in by Jackson and Van Buren. And the Van Buren government was $40 million in 1 year versus Adams' $13 million in 1 year. They did take this money from the bank, and they put it in state banks, which were actually insolvent, on the verge of breaking, and put it in these state banks and made money from the government funds
right across
the board.
Amazing. All righty, we are going to our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back after station ID. All righty, welcome back. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna Spingola. Our guest today is Michael Kirsch, and the article that he is talking about today, it's a 48-page article, which is available at LaRouchePack.com/AndrewJackson. It's linked on today's schedule page. And my atomic clock has found its bearings, and so now I feel better. It's amazing how dependent one can be on those things. We've often heard that Andrew Jackson referred to the bankers as a den of vipers. But in fact, this oft-used quote came from a privately printed six-page book. There were 310 copies made, called Andrew Jackson and the Bank of the United States, which I mentioned was written in 1928 by Stan V. Enkles, Jr. He claims that his father, in 1883, found the original minutes of the Philadelphia Citizens Committee, a group of men who went to Washington in 1834. Jackson, a typical politician, did not make that statement to these men, according to the official report as printed on March 1, 1834, in the Niles Weekly Register. A politician's actions are more significant than his words. In 1834, his administration, with his approval, was making a deal with the London Rothschilds. Okay, Michael.
Yeah, well, let me just say, it is very interesting today. People say that Nicholas Biddle worked with the Rothschilds and all that baloney. It was August Belmont who came in and worked with Van Buren, who was the Rothschild banker, who came in 1837, and his banks controlled the country from 1837 to 1860 before Lincoln became president because of what Jackson and Van Buren did. But let me just say, oftentimes people get confused at the Jackson administration because they did so many various things, and people can say, well, you know, he did a few bad things, sure. You know, he committed genocide against the Cherokees and moved all the Indians west. He did this and that. But it was not a bunch of crimes. It was a single intention of removing a set of policies that had been established since with the federal Constitution, the protection not only to every class of citizens, but to manufacturing as a key issue for developing and breaking from the British. Internal improvements, something that had been increasing, and especially since 1816 after the war with Britain, as a way to ensure the development of the West and the sovereignty of the country and the improvement and productivity of the resources of the land. And the Bank of the United States, by James Madison, who had dropped any misgiving against the bank and pushed it and got it through. These were not separate systems either. This was one policy called the American system. And John Quincy Adams, who created the State Department during the Monroe administration and pushed him also toward internal improvements, he had this policy. Abraham Lincoln, when he ran for office in 1832, he said, "My policies are short and sweet like an old woman's dance. I'm in favor of high tariffs, internal improvements, and a national bank." And this was the system. And so Jackson's administration was not a set of disconnected crimes. It was an intention to stop the United States from breaking with the British and from dominating the Western Hemisphere and completely breaking the possibility of the British Empire of succeeding. And that's what the policies, and similarly today and back then, the solution was not a separate set of policies. It's one system, the American credit system, or the American system, as you may want to call it.
Right. And it's very interesting, everything that you've said. And people are still finding this difficult to accept because of what they have been indoctrinated to believe. We are going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Michael Pirsch. There were 147 riots during 1835. 109 of them occurred between July and October due to Jackson's refusal to recharter the bank. Citizens were angry because officials now allocated federal funds to Jackson's friends, bank owners who invested in speculative ventures for the potential profits, but possibly at great risk. The Jackson administration, authorized by the Secretary of War, used the military to quash riots in 3 instances. So this is not good stuff, people. This is bad stuff. And he was not a man of the common people, which is religiously sustained by establishment historians. Jackson and his friends were all very wealthy. Okay, Michael, continue. And we will take some calls at the bottom of the hour at 800-313-9443. I know there's a lot of people who'd like to jump in on this.
Yeah, these were rhetorical speeches. I mean, all the speeches made were, you know, echoed Thomas Hart Benton's original speech. You know, who's Thomas Hart Benton? He's a close friend of John Randolph, you know, pro-British all the way, British East India Company, slavery of the South, rich landowner. These guys, they didn't like the credit provided for the poor people. They didn't like the idea that anybody could rise to an equality with everybody else because the bank provided credit. They wanted the gold and silver. If you've got the money, then you've got the money. If you don't, then you don't. You're not going to rise from your station. That was the mentality of the Southern slave owner. This is the liberty of the slave owner. It's, I'm with my private property, and the rest of the nation can go to hell. And that's what, in Jackson's 1832 speech, he signaled the new administration's policy. He said the government will now become a simple machine, and state sovereignties and free enterprise of our citizens will create improvements, meaning forget the internal improvements of the federal government. And 1833 compromised with the nullifiers and slave owners of the South, the only people who actually opposed the high tariffs. Here they had a huge increased representation in Congress, but they didn't want to pay their share for the nation, and they're the ones who are against protectionism for manufacturing. And throughout 1830s, beginning then, tariffs almost came down to nothing. By the end of the decade, we were shackled once again to Britain. We were dependent on foreign capital, back in debt, and going and hardly going anywhere with the internal improvements. This was the slave system.
Yes. And of course, then we all became debt slaves rather soon after that. It's also interesting, too, that that the Rothschilds actually made a deal with the Jackson administration. And it is in writing where there is communication between the London Rothschilds to function as the fiscal agent for the U.S. State Department. And there's letters going back and forth indicating that, according to President Andrew Jackson, that he okayed this affiliation and approved of the Rothschilds to be the fiscal the fiscal agent.
And it's even just more clear-cut. August Belmont was the lead agent for the Rothschilds, and Aaron Van Buren directly, he came into Van Buren's Democratic Party, and Van Buren handed him the torch. And so the whole party system and corruption of the New York banks that Van Buren had created, August Belmont came over as a young man and then and headed up the whole system all the way through the 1860s. And the Rothschild banks took over. The Barings Bank before that it was less influential with the rise of the Rothschilds after the Napoleonic Wars. And the Van Buren crowd, well, it's the bank. The bank is sovereignty over the finances. The Federal Reserve is not. So the people who want to compare the two, you've been misguided by this populism of Ron Paul. And it's very intentional by Ron Paul and the Mises Institute. This is the school of Austrian School of Economics. It's not the legacy of the United States. There was a very small handful of people who wanted pure gold money currency. The founders, all of them, the key founders, were for this credit of the bank. The bank was the way to break the shackles of the gold standard of England.
Right.
And that's what they did.
Didn't the colonists have their own script?
Yeah, they had their own script, but the problem was with that is that there wasn't a union. We didn't have a union. We didn't have taxes. So there was no credit behind the currency, and so it depreciated during the war. Until we had the union, the states, and especially those who wanted to push the Articles of Confederation, they were reluctant to act as a unity at all. And John Quincy Adams has a great speech for your listeners to look up. In 1839, he does a speech to the New York Historical Society, the 50th anniversary of the Constitution in 1839, and he reviews the whole history of the from the period between the Declaration of Independence and the formation of the Constitution. And that Constitution, by people like Robert Morris, Gouverneur Morris, Ben Franklin, George Washington, all the Philadelphia crowd, James Wilson, and Hamilton. That was the team that really, Gouverneur Morris and Wilson were the most active people at the convention, aside with Madison. These are the guys who created the federal powers in which the nation could exist, and the federal powers that would make a national currency and a credit system possible.
Right. Getting back to the Rothschilds, Secretary of State John Forsyth sent a letter, or actually received a letter, from the Rothschilds in London, dated September 29, 1834, in which they referred to the Secretary's letter of August 6. And it was a letter of confirmation regarding the services that N. M. Rothschild and Sons were going to perform in behalf of the United States government as the appointment of banker of the United States in Europe. And those services were to begin on January 1st, 1835, and Baring Brothers, as you mentioned, was eliminated, kicked out as that, because that they were functioning as the agent for the United States.
And that was crucial. You know, the idea is we can't be sovereign over our money. You know, whoever's got the gold has the money. And by shackling us again to London, London banks and Wall Street, which was rising in power beginning after the crash, which now said, well, we've got the private capital. And they were conveyor belts of Southern cotton, slave owner cotton. And the South was getting credit from Britain. So the South became a colony of England and of the British Empire. And all these Southern, you know, they were basically wanted to be like royalty. And it's no accident. All these Confederate people were going over and marrying, you know, duchesses and people up leading up to the Civil War. And they wanted to actually bring in a prince of the Confederacy. There's a whole other book on that. And we became a de facto colony again to the British by dropping protectionism almost to nothing by the end of the 1840s. And again, we just kind of coasted along toward the Civil War with the actions of Jackson, as John Quincy Adams forecast, with the cotton trade, with a dependent on the gold standard of England, right, and the sub-treasury system, and no credit at all. And the Rothschilds, completely took over, and that's absolutely crucial.
Right, and there's letters. The letters exist, people. I know there are people in the chat room saying, this is absolute nonsense, but the letters are evidence.
Yeah, and August Belmont.
Absolutely, August Belmont.
He ran the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party was the party of slavery and the party of Wall Street.
Exactly. And it's the evidence is there, people. It doesn't matter what you believe or what your opinions are or what you have been taught to believe. The evidence is there. The letters are there. The historical documents are there. But how many people actually look into these documents? How many people actually read the letters in the archives? No, they don't. They just believe what the court historians have been telling them.
And John Quincy Adams has been blacked out. And the other thing, the key point, John Quincy Adams and Monroe, they did not want the party system. It was Van Buren's operation to impose this party system on the United States. And what my article really goes through is that it was this party system which came in and just wrecked the country. The tool of the empire was to enforce this parliamentary system, which is the party system on the U.S. We don't need parties. And today, it's very clear, Republican and Democratic parties are both completely useless, and anyone that identifies either of the party lines is incapable of doing anything. We have to return to a nonpartisan team of patriots to pull us out of this mess today.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you there. So anyway, we are going to break in about a minute here, but if you would like to call in, make comments, ask questions, you may do that at 800-313-9443. And please do read this document. It is very important, has a lot of very good information, and will help us help you to understand, help all of us to understand what is going on today. Because as I said, history is prologue. And if you know what happened historically, then you can kind of figure out what's going on. So anyway, we will be right back after a word from our sponsors with our guest today, Michael Kirsch. Be right back. Deanna, our guest today is Michael Kirsch, and he wrote the article, How Andrew Jackson Destroyed the United States, and that is linked on today's schedule page, and will also be linked, of course, in the archives. And did you also cover in your article about how Taney was associated with the Cohens of Baltimore, and that he made a deal to have the government fund this private organization so that they could build the B&O Railroad?
I don't have that in my article.
Okay.
I know his relation, the fact that he was a stockholder to the Union Bank of Baltimore made his action was one of the legal violations involved. And yeah, he was also. There was a lot of questions about the solvency of that bank. And so they chose these various banks as, and that was the standard. They chose a bunch of banks. They got to choose who got the money. So all these banks are, you know, prostrating themselves to the administration. The administration suddenly has taken Congress's ability, of directing the funds. I mean, this is the higher crime, which is that it's a usurpation of the whole legislative branch of making contracts. Which is what now suddenly the executive, which is in charge of gathering the revenues, right, the import duties, the sale of the lands, Congress is supposed to decide how they're appropriated. The executive is just supposed to decide that they are. But now, now the executive is taking the legislative power of deciding how they're appropriated. And I don't think to this day we've ever completely restored the sovereignty over the I know we haven't, of the financial system to Congress.
Right. And all of this, a lot of this was done by executive order. And, yeah, it's just amazing how things worked out. And there was also, I mentioned the Cohens in Baltimore, and they had worked for the Rothschilds for years. And on July 20th, 1836, Jacob I. Cohen, and Company of Baltimore sent a celebratory unexpected gift to Britain to Nathan M. Rothschild, which was a painting of a uniformed Andrew Jackson during the Bank War. And this was to celebrate the fact that that the Rothschilds were now agents for the United States.
Yeah, that's right. Instead of the Bank of the United States, right. The Bank of the United States was the legislative act in 1791, and again in 1816, to be the regulator of the currency, the agent of all the government funds. People don't understand it today. The government, when the government collected taxes, internally and also for foreign duties, all of that money was still available to all the citizens by loans of the bank until the very moment that they were appropriated, and it was a large amount. So it was dispersed throughout the country in these various branches of the bank, and it wasn't that profitable to the bank to have them, in fact, because it was constantly fluctuating. But it was very profitable to the people. And today we should have a third bank of the U.S., which is also would perform that type of function.
Right, without usury.
Yeah, it was lower interest rate than all the Van Buren private New York banks. But I want to make a point on the railroad. I mean, whatever the issue is with the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, that was a project of the same day that the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal started. That was also the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, and the internal improvements groups were pushing these internal improvements. They were financed by the federal government. They weren't financed by the big bankers around the world. They were only financed. The railroads only began to be financed that way after it would be made impossible to finance them by the federal credit. And the state governments and the federal government, the lion's share of all internal improvements, rails and canals and roads, were done by those by those governments, not private finance. And the myth today is that the big banks, you know, built all the rails. They bought the rails up after they were built and never improved them at all.
Right. Except in this case, like Jacob I. Cohen was the president of the Baltimore-Philadelphia Railroad, and he was the director of the B&O Railroad and the president of the Baltimore Fire Insurance Company. And he was given government money, and it was at this time that these private owners came into being, and they were buying up things that should have been still public property.
Hmm.
That's how I understand it. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't. Well, yeah, it'd be worth looking more into. Another. I wrote another paper that I referenced in this paper, How Andrew Jackson Destroyed the United States, on the Second Bank of the United States, and one of the very old men, the last remaining survivor of the vault of the Declaration of Independence, and who pursued the Charles Carroll. That's right, and he was also someone pushing the anti-slavery societies. He was the guy who put his shovel in the ground to inaugurate the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. And this was the Army engineers of JQA and West Point were pursuing that. And they built these rails initially in the late 1820s, along the routes of the canals. And this was the arc between the Declaration of Independence and the last remaining survivor there in 1828 when they kicked that off.
All righty. We are going to a break. We'll be right back, and we'll take your calls at 800-313-9443. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Michael Kirsch, and he wrote the article, 48-page article, How Andrew Jackson Destroyed the United States. And let me just read something from the chat room. This guest is saying to put money back into Congress, who are nothing, or should be, who is nothing but thieves and change banks. Wrong solution. The only solution is to let each state print and regulate. Oops, I just lost it. Print and regulate its own money and get the feds out of the whole picture. This guest is doing nothing but parroting LaRouche, who can probably be considered controlled opposition. Your thoughts?
Well, the return of having states run that's unconstitutional. The federal government, Article 1, I think it's Section 10, prohibits the states from emitting bills of credit and such things. The power and the federal government is not prohibited. The federal government is responsible for creating the national currency. And why? Because the issue of credit is the intention of the nation as a whole to develop. And the currency of the nation should be a reflection of the intention of the nation to develop. Money itself has no self-evident value. Now, the listener, is the idea of states printing their own money, the principle of printed money is fine. That's what we should have. We want to have the idea of a currency and a credit system is that the currency is a reflection of the economy to develop. Why did I say Congress? Because Congress has the power to incorporate something like a Bank of the United States or to enact and push an act like the Tennessee Valley Authority Act or today the North American Water and Power Alliance Act. The Congress is representatives of the people. Yes, it has become corrupted very useless right now. What's that?
They are a bunch of thieves and corrupt. They don't actually represent us, and they're in there to line their own pockets.
Yeah,
but
the issue
didn't start out that way.
Yeah, but the issue is, it didn't start out that way. We've become increasingly worthless nation since the assassination of John F. Kennedy, but the problem is not that Congress is a bunch of thieves. The problem is that they're not using their power, and that's my point. They're giving everything over to Wall Street. That's where you should be focusing your rage, not at the Congress. The issue is you have to get the Congress to do what the Congress should do. The Congress has the power to create something, not the Federal Reserve, but to create a national currency that's reflective of the powers of the nation. And only the Congress and the national government has to do that. We should not be thinking about seceding into a bunch of different states. The solution is to return to the Hamiltonian credit system and have the powers of Congress, as I said, not to give Congress a bunch of money. The issue is to give Congress the power to legislate a bank, the People's Bank, which they can benefit from, that can channel all the remaining productivity of the country into building a new generation of manufacturing and large projects and such things, and create a national currency that can do that.
All right. Well, we certainly do need something other than what we have now, because what we have now is just disastrous, and the only people that are benefiting are the people who are serving the bankers, and of course the bankers and all of these bailouts, people living on the street, people losing their home. This is a disastrous situation, and it's only getting worse.
And let me just say something about Lyndon LaRouche here. He has been pushing for the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall. Now, the real, if you want to say Lyndon LaRouche is part of the, you know, he's part of the secret elite, and he's, now look, this is a bunch of baloney. We've been pushing the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act since 2007, and then pushing the Glass-Steagall Act as the way to actually take this Wall Street London financial oligarchy and put these guys, you know, into bankruptcy. Their money is useless. In fact, we can do the same thing. We can say your money is worthless. All your derivatives are worthless. And, you know, the way that Jackson said suddenly, hey, we're not going to accept this money anymore. Look, we can take all these guys and hang them out to dry. And Lyndon LaRouche has been key exposing this. You reference his book, Dope Inc. The whole international drug trade and running these operations around the world is run through this, you know, these private financial banks. HSBC is now being let off the hook. Just yesterday, they got a big fine instead of being convicted of money laundering. The Glass-Steagall Act that Lyndon LaRouche has been pushing, this is the way to return to regulated banking around the country. Then what you do is you create a national bank that actually you can get a loan from, like the Second Bank of the United States. You could go down and get a loan to build a canal. You can't do that with the Federal Reserve. All they do is create more debt. We go into debt to private banks who then keep using that for speculation. And Congress has to take back its power of Article 1, Section 8, and use it fully to actually fulfill their duties to the people.
Right. And certainly they are not doing that because they are benefiting from their corruption and their complicity with the banks.
And they're afraid of them because people think it's all about money. And the Wall Street crowd goes into Congress and they lobby and they say, well, you don't understand. You know, I've got a degree in finance and let me tell you how the economy works. And it's really not that mysterious. And that's what this article is trying to show, is that the way in which the economy grew on the greatest leap forward, and the way in which the role of credit instead of money, the idea is people get this fixation about money and the free market and everything's just going to work out fine if the government's gone and the free market reigns. Well, that idea of the free market gold and silver was imposed by the British to re-enslave us. And we have to realize the correct role of the relationship between government and the economy was how it functioned under John Quincy Adams, Abraham Lincoln, and under Franklin Roosevelt with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation.
Well, I don't buy that. Differences of opinion about that, and certainly and somebody also mentioned Kennedy, that he certainly was not an angel. But he was assassinated, and I don't believe that it was because of money. I believe it was because of his stance against Israel and their nuclear aspirations. But there's just so much corruption and so many things that anyway, this is a good article that you have created, and certainly does expose Andrew Jackson. And he definitely needed exposure.
And the issue is, and we can, you can invite me on again, we can talk about FDR or something, but the issue is, what's the intention of the nation? Do we have a mission? And under these presidents, we move forward, you know, the space program. With Roosevelt, we move forward with the dam projects, the Four Corner projects around the country. Do we have a mission? And Lincoln, you know, he moved us out west and completed John Quincy Adams' vision of the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yeah, but it took 722,000 deaths to do that. I think it could have been done without the Civil War, the so-called Civil War. When you look at the families, too, most of these presidents have come from very, very elite families. FDR was from the banking family. And certainly during the time that he was doing what you said he was doing, the country was in this major depression. And, of course, you had the crash of 1929, which was all done by the bankers.
Right.
And so it's which you can look back to the crash of 1837, 1893, 1907, 1929. All of these crashes were done by the banks, and it was done to make us more obedient and to change the culture and to change the structure of government and to make us all more indebted. And look at all the laws that have been put in place after each of these crashes and after each of the wars. Look at the big change in government after World War II.
Well, the Constitution was set up to create a set of powers that would actually allow us to succeed in breaking from the British Empire. We were falling into bankruptcy, states by each state having its own sovereignty, not a representation by the people. And Hamilton and as I said before, these other people in Philadelphia that were working directly with Ben Franklin, they set up the best way to create a system was the Bank of the United States, which would allow to have control over the finances and make all of the available assets of the country, idle wealth, now available to all the people. All the idle wealth available in the bank.
That's very idealistic, yeah.
And it was then done again in 1816.
Right.
And
okay,
why
don't we take a caller? We've got some callers lining up. Go ahead and finish your comment. I hate to break that.
Oh, I'm just there's a whole arc you can look at of the way in which we were growing as a nation, and it was always this one system, this American system, which has been blacked out today from all the history books, and people think it's either free trade or communism, but there was a different system we had in place.
All righty, okay. Let's take John in Georgia. John, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, something like that. How you doing? What I wanted to do was, I honestly believe that I have the solution to all of this. And I'm going to throw this out there, and you guys can think about it. You can check it out and see if there's any truth to this. I say, first of all, we need to end the corporate state, the corporate courts. Now, I'm speaking from my own personal experience with the corporate courts and all of this. We need to reassert our courts. And we need a change of ownership. And what I mean by that is we, the people, become the new owners. And we can do this. And it's a legal coup is what I've been calling for about 5 years. And so what I'm suggesting is, for instance, as an example, the churches seem to do quite well. They don't have a gun and a badge. They simply is by voluntary contributions to the church. They do some good in the communities, and I'm not speaking in the sense that we should do like the church exactly. I'm just suggesting the churches seem to do quite well. They're only asking for 10%. We take, and we can start this whole movement in the United States by simply limiting the sales tax at 10%. Cap it at 10%. 10% is a phenomenal amount of money. When you think about it, we eliminate the IRS, we get rid of the income tax, all of these things that are unconstitutional. In other words, what you'll find in the legal sense is a conflict of interest at every level. Every level of government that exists. It's high crimes and treason. All you got to do is look at these poor kids in some of these other countries like Iraq, who wanted to go to the Golden R. You look at Libya. You name it. They have committed crimes against humanity for a very long time, and we have them grossly outnumbered. We change ownership. We, the people, take ownership back, okay? Nobody has to lose their jobs. We don't have to change anything. When we shut down the Federal Reserve and we go back to this 10% of the states and let the Fed come and beg the states for money when they got some flaky program they want to put in place, this is how it's done. We force their hand. You understand what I'm saying? And I'll bet that these papers that we filed to make it a legal transition will be found in the IRS code. They have got this confiscatory law down to a science, and we can take what they have used on us and flip it and use it on them. And once we start that, there's enough countries around the world that will follow suit, that will come on board probably immediately. Once we have our courts back, we can seek remedy in these corporate courts for all the harm they've caused. But we must take the apparatus, and the main one is all of this electronic processing. What I understand is about $320 billion a day that they skim from all of these transactions globally. That's a lot of money.
We have to freeze their assets.
We have to seize and freeze their assets. Forget them. They're going to run in time.
John, let's let,
we can go after
let's
them
let
later.
Michael respond to your comments.
Well, I think the issue of the people, you know, the people taking it, it's true, but, you know,
The issue is, John,
let Michael respond to your comments, please.
Sure.
Yeah, the people, you know, you look at what we've been talking about today, the people's bank, right? This was the people's bank, not the government bank. And the people have to control the finances of the nation. The nation has to control its own finances. We are,
absolutely.
We have been imposed by the system of globalization, which is getting rid of all sovereignty over finance, over our own money. We don't control we can't regulate the currency anymore. We're not allowed to regulate the currency. We're not allowed to develop our own industries. Everything is globalization. And Tony Blair has been pushing this policy, saying we're going to shut down any capability of nation states to have their own currencies. We're going to let them be flooded with foreign currencies, and we're going to shut down the power over, you know.
Okay, now, Michael, let me ask you a question. Do you agree that all the currencies, fiat, whatever you want to call them, you can call them whatever you want, faith-based money, faith-based.
But the issue is, you're right, but the issue is what has to have credit. Credit comes from the intention to develop industry. You can't, if you can't make good on something, then you have no credit. I mean, that's really the meaning of the currency. You have to be able to build. You say, well, we're going to complete this bridge. We're going to do this great project. Right now, around the country, we need water. We're drying out. This terrible drought. We're shutting down our herds. I've talked to farmers around the country. We're downsizing our herds. Our food security is going out the window. Some people in the farmers union say this. Look, we don't even have enough food on reserve for 3 to 5 weeks if everything is shut down. We can build a flood control system. The intention to complete it is the credibility of a government. If the government can organize and the nation's productive forces, the companies, the tunnel boring machines, the cement companies, the steel factories, the heavy machinery, if all of these forces can look to a government that's actually intended to complete a project, then the money that the government would create out of something like a national bank would have value.
Can I make a brief comment before you hang up?
We do need to go to a break. We will be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today has been Michael Kirsch. He is the author of How Andrew Jackson Destroyed the United States. I hope that everyone will read that document. It's 48 pages long, and he provides some very good information in that document. And we have been certainly indoctrinated by the court historians about what to think, and it's very difficult, I think, for some people to forget what they have learned and accept and be objective and look at new things. And we need to do that and draw our own conclusions rather than other people's opinions. I believe that John hung up, but Michael, would you like to, we've got about 3 minutes.
Yeah, let me just say for those listening, this article that you read is not the normal article that you find online. This is based on original sources. The articles that I write, I review all of the original materials, because you have to, if you want to know what the truth is, you actually have to know that there is something that's true, there is something that's false, and you can't just run around as most people do today and just peel stuff off of Wikipedia and online. And that's why everybody is continuing to circulate and repeat these slanders about the Bank of the United States and comparing it with Ron Paul's slogans and so forth. This document has the original 1834, 1835, 1833 speeches of John Quincy Adams, how he takes apart all of this. Thomas McKinney, most people have never heard of him. He wrote a whole book on the spirit of Jacksonism. All of the original quotes from Van Buren, Nicholas Biddle's papers, and what these guys were actually doing. The whole thing is based on the real documents that you're going to find, and it's something you haven't seen this. Most of this stuff has been buried for almost 200 years. And so I would really challenge people to read through this. And it's also based on some work that Tony Chaykin, a different historian, has pulled on the treason of Aaron Burr and that whole network in making Jackson become the president. And most people have no idea about that also. And then the crash and all of the original documents of the people themselves, enormous amount went into creating this report. And it's something that we can hopefully break Congress from the axioms of fixating on just cutting the budget. That is an axiom that came from Van Buren. The way that Van Buren dealt with the crash was to mock the people and say the only thing now is to pay your debts, and took away Congress's ability to create credit for the people and for projects and things.
Right. I mean, just look what is happening now. The people are expected to work less hours. And it's the people that are being hurt. It isn't Congress. I mean, Congress doesn't even have to accept Obamacare, but it's the people. It's all about hurting the people, hurting the citizens. And we're supposed to have a voice in government. We have no voice at all. And that was certainly set up decades and decades ago. Well, 200 years ago.
I'd like to invite people. You call 1-800-929-7566. That's 1-800-929-7566. You want to order a copy of my report or to get more information about it.
Right. And it's also available online. And that link is posted in the archives. So thank you so very much, Michael, for being on the program today and presenting this information.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for having me, Deanna. And I'd be interested in answering anybody else's questions.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you tomorrow.